Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight.
It doesn't matter whether it's in 6 minutes, 6 days, or 6 weeks. We're going to get it done.
High stakes. President Biden goes to Capitol Hill to try to make progress on the infrastructure and spending bills. Then, vaccinating migrants. With about 70% of the population in Europe inoculated, concerns are rising over how to vaccinate hundreds of thousands of undocumented migrants.
In this area, one of the problems that we face is that they organize the vaccination in a big hub. But there are many people here, Italian, poor Italian, and poor foreigners that they have no car to reach this place.
And it's Friday. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart on the challenges the Biden administration is facing getting its economic and social agenda passed. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Another day on Capitol Hill with no vote on infrastructure and no deal on a bigger spending package. But as Lisa Desjardins reports, President Biden made a direct appeal to Democrats.
Not an everyday sight, a president on Capitol Hill. And the goal of President Biden's visit with House Democrats today, to get his agenda back on track.
I'm telling you, we're going to get this done. It doesn't matter when. It doesn't matter whether it's in 6 minutes, 6 days, or 6 weeks. We're going to get it done.
House Democrats began this day fractured still over whether to go ahead and hold a vote now on a trillion-dollar infrastructure bill.
We're working through these issues, and I believe, as we always do, we're going to land the plane.
Speaker Nancy Pelosi had promised to call a vote, being specific with reporters yesterday.
Are you committed to having a vote on infrastructure today?
Yes.
Regardless of whether you have the votes or not?
I intend to.
But the day ended with no vote. Some House progressives, led by Pramila Jayapal, remained firm holdouts, seeking more commitments on an even larger bill covering climate, health care, and other priorities. Jayapal stressed a handshake deal isn't good enough.
I have consistently said that we need a vote in the Senate because I want to make sure that there are no delays, that there are no mix-ups, that there are no mixed understandings about what the deal is.
But the fate of that larger so-called reconciliation bill also hinges on moderate Senate Democrats, Kirsten Sinema and Joe Manchin. Both say it must be smaller than what progressives want. Amidst it all, some House Democrats said they wanted more from Biden.
The time is now. He has that singular power to unify.
So he could be doing more at this point?
I think he can be doing more in front of us, yes.
Very few of us have seen the president in the 9 months he's been president.
The White House has said Biden is engaging and had been making calls to Democrats around the clock. He scrapped a planned event in Chicago to focus on finding agreement this week on the Hill.
And Lisa is here with me now in the studio, along with Amna Nawaz, covering the White House today. So hello to both of you. Lisa, looks like a lot of action, but no clear movement toward any vote. Where does everything stand?
I do not think there will be an infrastructure vote tonight. There will be a vote on something else, though. In that infrastructure bill was a reauthorization for the Highway Trust Fund. That ran out last night at midnight. So Democrats have to deal with that. We expect a 30-day extension of that. There's no real problems from a day lag in that or a few days lag in that. They will take that action. But overall, Democrats now are doing something that one member said there is redoing the conversation from scratch. I want to talk about this issue about Pelosi's promise to have that infrastructure vote today. She said that yesterday. Let's figure out what happened there. I want to explain this to people. For you and I, Judy, a day is 24 hours. That seems very normal, right? But however, there is a legislative day. And here, Pelosi's talking about something that can go on indefinitely. We are still in the legislative day of September 30th in the House of Representatives. A legislative day can go on forever. In fact, one time, the late Senator Robert Byrd had one go on for over 100 calendar days. So a little bit of a Jedi mind trick there, I think, that Pelosi is pulling. We'll see if she actually ends this legislative day and says we need more time. When you talk to members, it is clear that the president's visit tonight was a huge morale boost. And moreover, it provided clarity that they needed from him that he is still on board both of these bills, moving at the same time, not one in front of the other. That was important clarity that members didn't have.
And speaking of the president, Amna, we were hearing some Democratic members expressing frustration there that the president hasn't been as visible on this. What is your understanding of just how involved he is right now?
You know, and you asked the White House, where has the president been? They said, well, he's been very involved. The White House has been involved all along. They point again and again to a team of senior advisors and senior staff who they say have been in close contact with every group and every faction of the Democratic caucus. Here's the group that they point to. We've seen them before. They are leading the charge on Capitol Hill. Susan Rice, of course, leads the Domestic Policy Council. Ron Klain is the chief of staff. Brian Deese, who heads the Economic Council. Louisa Terrell, who heads Legislative Affairs. And Steve Ricchetti, of course, who's a senior counselor to the president. The White House says, look, many of them were on the Hill till midnight last night. Since September 1st, there have been over 300 calls and meetings with members and staff directors. They say, we've been making the case. We have been there. We've been involved. But today, they say, and Press Secretary Jen Psaki was asked about this in the briefing, today was the day President Biden felt was the day to go make the case directly to those members, reassure them we will get there. Compromises will be reached. They have to be made. Both sides have to give a little. No direct timeline. But he wants to reassure them they're moving forward. He's committed.
Well, one of the things that's become clear is that it's not going to be a $3.5 trillion social spending bill, whatever the name of it is, reconciliation. It's going to be a number lower than that. What are you hearing from the White House about what they are willing to live with?
So, of course, we are pressing again and again, trying to get a number from them. What are you comfortable with? What do you think the president would sign off on? The two names we heard more than any other names in the briefing today, Senators Manchin and Sinema. They know they have to get some kind of guidance from them, and at the same time reassure progressives that big agenda is going to move forward.
And Lisa, finally, back to you. Where does it go from here if you don't expect a vote tonight? And what does this mean for the Democrats? I mean, this was their chance to put their stamp on what's going to happen in this country.
It's even more clear today, Judy, that this is really the beginning, the earnest beginning of negotiations. And at this beginning point, where the conversation is behind closed doors, I have sources, and Yamiche has reported this before too, the conversation seems to be around $2 trillion to $2.5 trillion. Even some progressives said that maybe they can accept something in that area. Of course, there is a big conversation about then what is it that gets cut? That's what they're going to have to do soon. But I think for the next week, it is going to be about what size that both sides can perhaps get their hands around. Probably not a firm number, but somewhere in that $2 to $2.5 is what we're talking about right now. I also want to say, it seems like this has been a chaotic week for Democrats. Speaker Pelosi pledged a vote. That vote didn't happen. That's not good for a speaker. But I want to remind people that the Affordable Care Act took over 8 months to get through Congress. And on that vote, the Affordable Care Act in the House, Democrats lost 39 of their members, and they still passed it. Here, Speaker Pelosi can only lose three. That's why this is so much harder. And the Affordable Care Act was also difficult. So this is really threading the tiniest of legislative needles. But I think I have to say I was convinced by both progressives and moderates today that they are talking more in unison. They're moving towards similar goals. Once they get down to the details, it's going to get hard again.
But, of course, they've known all along how tight this margin is.
That's right.
So we will see. Lisa Desjardins, Amna Nawaz, thank you both.
Welcome.
In the day's other news, drug maker Merck reported that its experimental pill reduces COVID hospitalizations and deaths by 50% for those recently infected. The company plans to seek federal approval for the drug. We'll have more on the potential of this new treatment after the news summary. California has announced the nation's first statewide COVID-19 vaccination mandate for school children. Governor Gavin Newsom said that it will be phased in 7th through 12th grades and then kindergarten through 6th as vaccines for different age groups win final FDA approval. Newsom said it is clear that vaccine mandates work.
I think the evidence is rather overwhelming. They're getting people vaccinated. They're actually ending this pandemic. And if that's the intention, to keep us healthy and safe and get our economy moving and get our kids back with all the benefits of being in-person instruction, then all I say is let's get this done and let's get others to follow suit.
Later, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor refused to block New York City's vaccine mandate for public school employees. It took effect this evening. The legal dispute continues in lower courts. Also today, the High Court said Justice Brett Kavanaugh has tested positive for COVID. He is fully vaccinated and shows no symptoms. The news came just ahead of the opening of the court's new term on Monday. Justices plan to hear arguments in person for the first time since the pandemic began. The United Nations condemned Ethiopia today over its treatment of the rebel Tigray region and warned that millions are facing famine. The UN's humanitarian office said civilians are in desperate need because the Ethiopian government is blocking food aid.
It is critically important that the humanitarian operation continues, and it does. We have a very high number of people in very urgent need. In Tigray. In fact, 5.2 million people up there are in urgent need of assistance.
The world body also charged that Ethiopia had no legal right to expel seven senior UN officials yesterday. The country's government accused the officials of meddling in its internal affairs. Demonstrators in Iraq today mark 2 years since nationwide protests demanding political reform. Roughly 1,000 people marched in Baghdad. Many held photos of loved ones who were killed by security forces during the unrest. They also renewed calls for change ahead of parliamentary elections next week. Back in this country, a federal judge in Texas is now considering whether to block the state's new abortion law. At a hearing in Austin today, the U.S. Justice Department argued for an injunction. The Texas law bans most abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. It also lets private citizens enforce the ban by suing anyone who aids in an abortion. On Wall Street, stocks opened October with gains after slumping in September. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 482 points, 1.4%, to close at over 34,000. The Nasdaq rose 118 points. The S&P 500 added 49. And Jimmy Carter, the nation's oldest living ex-president, turned 97 today. He marked the occasion quietly at his home in Plains, Georgia. Mr. Carter survived cancer in 2015, and he and his wife, Rosalind, celebrated their 75th wedding anniversary in July. Happy birthday. Still to come on the NewsHour, how a new drug could change the way COVID is treated and reduce hospitalizations and deaths. The challenge to get hundreds of thousands of migrants in Europe vaccinated. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart on the political precariousness of the president's economic agenda, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington, and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The country will soon pass another grim number, 700,000 Americans who have died from COVID and related complications. The best way to stop the spread and prevent infection are vaccines, of course. But throughout the pandemic, there have not been many helpful or easy treatment options once people become infected. Now, as William Brangham reports, a new antiviral drug from Merck offers hope for keeping patients with COVID-19 out of the hospital and alive.
That's right, Judy. The only information we have about this drug comes from Merck itself. Federal regulators and regulators abroad haven't seen any of their data. But an independent board reviewing the drug's initial trial said it should be stopped early because results were so promising. The company is now seeking approval for widespread use. To understand how this might help fight the pandemic, I'm joined again by Dr. Naheed Bhadelia. She's an infectious disease specialist at Boston University School of Medicine, where she runs the Center for Emerging Infectious Diseases Policy and Research. Dr. Bhadelia, great to have you back on the NewsHour. What do you make of this drug? Is this a possible new tool for us?
Well, William, if the data pans out, an oral antiviral has been the missing piece in the way that we respond to this pandemic. And the reason it's important is because Currently, the data that's presented by this press release, which of course we need to validate, shows that if given in the first 5 days of illness, it can reduce hospitalizations and deaths by 50% in people who at least have one medical condition. The difference, though, is compared to monoclonal antibodies, this is something that you can take by mouth. And the use of monoclonals has been limited is because it requires intravenous infusion, and that requires a clinic. If you can give something by mouth quickly after diagnosis, you're improving the access of the drug to more people, you're keeping more people from getting into the hospitals, and you may also reduce the time that people are contagious, which could reduce transmission as well. So a lot of promise there, although the one thing that I will say is that it needs to be linked with testing. We're limited a bit on the way that we test, and you have to have confirmed COVID-19 to then qualify to take this pill. But right now, rapid tests we're still being plagued by shortages in many parts of the world, as well as in this country.
Right. You can't give the drug to people who are infected if you can't figure out who's actually infected. So it's easier to use. You don't need to do it in a hospital. It's in a pill form. Sounds like you don't need to refrigerate it or any of those concerns like we have with the vaccines. Are there other challenges? I mean, do you have a sense of how quickly this might be manufactured and distributed? Again, if it gets approved.
I think that we would have to hear from the manufacturer about their capacity, right? This is a couple of good things about this drug as well as potential caveats. So I'll start with the caveats. One is it's not a replacement for vaccines because it's always going to be better for you not to get infected. You know, this is a drug that you'd get if you ended up getting, unfortunately, a breakthrough infections, or if you're in an under-vaccinated area, which are seeing, of course, high rates of hospitalizations. It'll make a big impact. In terms of manufacturing, Mark would have to create enough of this drug, right? Not just to have an impact here, but hopefully that there could be some effort to produce enough of it to also be distributed to parts of the world where vaccines are not available more readily and where healthcare systems are getting overwhelmed with the appearance of every new variant of this virus.
So can you explain how that works? If ideally we get vaccines to every nation and every population that wants them, but prior to that, you're sort of describing this as a kind of a bridge until vaccines get out there. How does this compare to what a vaccine does as far as its effect on your body?
This is a drug, an antiviral, that stops the replication of the virus by introducing errors when the virus tries to copy itself, right? And in some ways, this is similar to some of the HIV drugs that are on the market that do the same kind of work. It's a different type of technology than some of the messenger RNA vaccines that require specialized production. And hopefully, you know, the barriers to manufacturing this in multiple places may be less because it is technology that could be known. They're a bridge potentially to get to places that haven't been vaccinated enough, but they might also be a bridge, William, if, for example, because of the way that they work, the antivirals might be a bit more resilient against new variants. So let's say a new variant appears on the scene, these drugs may actually be a bridge until we can have a beat to update the vaccine to have them address the variants a bit better.
I know you are an infectious disease scientist, but I'm going to ask you a social science question as well. And every time we've seen a new treatment that comes out in this country, we've seen such divergent reactions to it. We have this safe, effective vaccine that millions of people are suspect about, and yet those same people sometimes will embrace untested, unproven treatments for COVID-19. Let's just say this drug gets approved. Do you have any sense of whether or not this would be embraced by people or whether this would be the subject of further conspiracy theories?
Well, I think disinformation and misinformation are challenges that are unfortunately here to stay. And, you know, and I would not be surprised if there was some amount of misinformation, disinformation around these drugs as well. I think what hurts us is when those, you know, disinformation and misinformation pieces actually get amplified by larger media platforms around certain drugs or vaccines, which is what you saw with these highly effective vaccines. So I'm holding out my pessimism potentially that even despite having a potential antiviral that is available, that we may see scenarios where people just don't take them because they get politicized. And I really hope we don't see that.
Well, let's hope when we see the data that there's actually some good news. Nice to occasionally be able to report that. Dr. Naheed Bhadelia, always good to see you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
As Europe prepares for the new arrivals of refugees fleeing Afghanistan, there are concerns that undocumented migrants already living on the continent are being left out when it comes to COVID-19 vaccines. The European Union has now inoculated over 70% of its population. But in Italy alone, around 700,000 migrants are thought to be flying under the radar. Special correspondent Lucy Hoff has this report from Naples.
Frustration is running high. First, a wait for paperwork, now a wait for the vaccine. This pop-up clinic comes to the town of Castelvolturno on the outskirts of Naples twice a week. Each time, hundreds of people turn up hoping for an appointment, but there are not enough doses to go around. For many people living here, this is the only opportunity to get a COVID-19 shot. Sergio Serena runs this center, operated by the aid group Emergency.
In this area, the one of the problems that we face is that they organize the vaccination in a big hub, big vaccination center. But there are many people here, Italian, poor Italian, and poor foreigners that they have no car to reach this place that they are at 50 kilometers. So we decided to organize this vaccination day, but there are no the space to allow more than 400 people to enter.
Italy, once the epicenter of COVID-19 in Europe, is now beginning its recovery from the pandemic. But residents here in Castelvolturno say they feel left behind. This was once a holiday destination for Italy's southern elite, but after becoming a hotspot for organized crime in the 1960s, its tourists and many residents left. Now a portrait of neglect, its abandoned villas house thousands of asylum seekers and undocumented people. Abdul Thomas from the Gambia is one of them.
Life is very hard, that is true, but it's getting more hard every day.
He says being unvaccinated makes it more difficult for him to find work.
I have to go out and search for a job to do. Because if I don't do a job, who will want to help me? I have to survive.
When Italy started its vaccination program at the start of the year, those without a social security number were unable to book a slot. In June, the rollout was opened to include migrants and the homeless, around 700,000 people. But in practice, logistical and cultural barriers remain. Online booking systems can still be difficult to access. Here in Castelvolturno, distrust towards the vaccine runs high. The focus is now on outreach to those who feel uncertain. Luciano Gualderi is from the Italian Center for Migrant Medicine.
One of the difficulties is getting information out there about what is on offer, accessing hard-to-reach people who don't have documents or access to health care. But it can be challenging. There's a lot of misinformation out there about the vaccines, particularly AstraZeneca.
Local authorities say there are around 35,000 undocumented foreigners living near Naples who need to be vaccinated.
This region of Campania in southwest Italy was one of the first to start vaccinating its undocumented people. But a very small percentage of that group are taking up the shot compared to the wider population. That's a pattern that's repeating across Europe.
There are an estimated 4.8 million unauthorized immigrants living in Europe. Experts are warning that failure to tackle low rates of vaccination in these vulnerable groups could prolong the pandemic. Benedetta Armisida is a researcher in public health at the University of Geneva.
COVID-19 pandemic has exacerbated those inequities. For example, factors that increase migrants' risk of exposure to SARS-CoV-2 include working conditions, living condition, so living in an overcrowded accommodation, lack of hygiene and sanitation, and lower level of accessibility to public health services, including public health messaging.
Back in December, the European CDC recommended refugees and migrants be included in national vaccine strategies, but only a small number of EU countries have put that into practice. France and Belgium are amongst those who've prioritised these groups from the start. Belgium runs mobile vaccine units to reach those without a permanent address. Sami Mehdi is the Belgian Minister for Migration.
The question is, why is it important to vaccinate as much people as possible? And not what are your documents in order to know if you should get vaccinated or not. I mean, the virus doesn't make a difference between if you have papers in Belgium or not. So we need to vaccinate as much people as possible to be able to get rid of the masks, to get rid of all the COVID measures that we take nowadays.
But elsewhere, it's a different story. In Hungary, non-residents are all but barred from vaccine systems. Greece still requires documents to register online. In Germany, a law requires local authorities to alert immigration services about undocumented people. That risk of identification means many steer clear of the vaccine. Advocates say European governments need to do more to address issues of trust. Alina Smith works for a group pushing for greater cooperation on migrant issues.
What we've seen is the importance of countries really being very, very clear and very, very strong in their commitment to respecting, for example, the right to data protection and confidentiality, so that data that would become available because the person is seeking to be vaccinated would not then be used for immigration control purposes or any purposes not related to public health.
Europe is under pressure, facing a surge in case numbers of the Delta variant. Questions are already being asked about the inclusivity of its member states' healthcare systems. A fresh wave of migration of those fleeing Afghanistan could add further strain. Europe's vaccine rollout may be nearing its final stages, but many people, like these trying to get into Castelvolturno's vaccine pop-up, fear they will continue to be overlooked. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Lucy Hoff in Naples.
The British government is warning that the country's fuel crisis is likely to last for at least another week. Gas stations across Britain have had to shut down because a shortage of truckers has led to widespread lack of available fuel. As special correspondent Malcolm Brabant reports from Brighton on the southern coast of England, the problems appear to be one of the side effects of Brexit.
Illuminated gas station signs at night are like homing beacons for Britain's fuel-starved drivers.
It's nearly 2 o'clock in the morning, and I can't believe that just a half an hour ago I woke up and I thought, oh, I don't have any petrol, I'd better go and get some, because this is about the only time of night you can get it.
That is, if you don't want to waste time and even more fuel during daylight hours waiting in a gridlocked line at a gas station that's just had a delivery. Sure enough, shortly after dawn, this facility was besieged. Britain has 8,300 gas stations, and according to industry analysts, more than a quarter of them are empty. For those who don't use public transport or cycle, the fuel famine is becoming what the understated British regard as irritating. Artist Jessica Christie Miller.
I had my sister Charlotte staying with me, who has learning difficulties, right, and I couldn't get her back to Kent. My husband's broken his knee, and I have to get him to the hospital. It's getting expensive in taxis and alternative travel arrangements.
What do you think is the real core reason?
It's clearly a combination of Brexit, coronavirus, and a lack of being happy to keep the same workers that we've had.
She's not alone in blaming the crisis on Britain's exit from the European Union. Many voters voted for Brexit to end the right of other Europeans to live and work in Britain. Many of Britain's truckers came from Eastern Europe. Feeling underpaid and unloved, thousands returned home during the pandemic. Businessmen like Usman Ahmed are losing faith in the competence of Boris Johnson's Conservative government.
It's a bit farcical, to be honest. That's been run very poorly at the moment. Can you solely blame the government for something like this? Well, I think foresight would have been quite useful.
It wasn't long before this gas station ran out of diesel. The government is spinning this as a temporary supply blip. It says it has a battalion of military drivers ready to go. It's also granting emergency visas to 5,000 foreign drivers. Business Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng.
I'm not guaranteeing anything. All I'm saying is that I think the situation is stabilising. I think people realise that this will pass.
Just 3 miles away from this gas station at the Labour Party annual conference, opposition leader Keir Starmer twisted the knife.
Prime Minister, either get a grip or get out of the way and let us step up and clear up this mess.
As the crisis continues, opinion polls suggest most Britons would prefer Starmer to Boris Johnson as Prime Minister. Johnson, a former journalist, blamed the media for the crisis.
Unfortunately, there was a slightly misleading account of something which got leaked and caused a big, totally understandable surge in public demand. We think we can, you know, the actual number of lorry drivers that were short in that particular sector isn't very big.
Britain is short of at least 90,000 truckers, and without them, supply chains for gas and other businesses are in jeopardy. Business analyst Nick Peters worries that Britain is becoming an international laughingstock.
The great promise post-Brexit was that the UK would be free to develop a new global power base and become this entrepreneurial hotspot. The fact of the matter is, at the moment, that given these crises, the country is riven with disagreements over how to go forward. People don't have any faith in the government at all. We're in a desperate time in this country. At the moment, people are looking at us from overseas and just wondering what the heck is going on.
Across the channel in Brussels, European policy analyst Sophie Pornschlegel says Britain's former partners are more concerned than amused.
UK politicians and especially Brexiteers really backed themselves into a corner and now they can't get out of it. They said that we would have opportunities with Brexit that just didn't happen. And what you see now is the negative consequences to not have freedom of movement.
The fear in Britain is that this shortage is just a taste of things to come and it'll be worse by Christmas. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Malcolm Brabant in Brighton.
The National Women's Soccer League has suspended all of its weekend matches amid allegations of abuse, including sexual abuse of players by former coaches. Amna Nawaz is back with a look at the widening scandal.
Judy, the games were postponed after the players demanded an end to what they call systematic abuse in the league. On Thursday, North Carolina's professional team, the Courage, fired coach Paul Riley following reports he sexually coerced multiple players. According to a report this week by The Athletic, Riley coerced one player to have sex with him, forced two players to kiss one another, and sent unsolicited sexual pictures. Another coach, the coach of the Washington Spirit, was fired earlier this week after the Washington Post reported he verbally and emotionally abused players. This now makes three coaches total. The National Women's Soccer League has fired in its ranks for misconduct since August. I'm joined now by Molly Hensley Clancy. She's an investigative sports reporter for the Washington Post. Molly, welcome to the NewsHour. Thanks for joining us. This league is just a few years old. It's less than a decade old. This year alone, three coaches fired since August. Why are we learning about all this now?
I think the simple answer is that up until this moment, players simply haven't felt able to speak out. They've been too afraid of losing their jobs, and they haven't had the security to do it. In my case, I heard that players had been leaving the Washington Spirit because of verbal and emotional abuse by the coach, Richie Burke. But it took a player going on the record, Kaya McCullough. She was really willing to speak out about what she'd endured, and she became the first player in the league to really say with her name to it what had happened to her. And then I think yesterday, this Athletic story about Paul Riley had details that were absolutely harrowing, that really cut to the heart of some of the stuff that players have been going through, the sexual coercion. And it implicated the league in failures to really address the problem. And that really angered a lot of players.
And we've seen some outrage from some of the superstars of the sport, right? The women's national team members, people like Megan Rapinoe and Alex Morgan online. The players' union has come out and basically said the league failed us, that league officials knew about this going on and didn't do anything about it. So, Molly, what do we know about what officials knew, when they knew it, and what they did or didn't do?
In the case of Paul Riley, Alex Morgan actually posted some emails on Twitter that showed that one of Riley's victims had gone to the league commissioner, Lisa Baird, in April and basically begged Baird to open an investigation into the behavior. They had done a previous investigation in 2015 of him. The Portland Thorns had found that he had violated their policies. He was dismissed or his contract wasn't renewed. And then he was hired back into the league within months. And in this case with Lisa Baird, she did not investigate the victim's claims, and she eventually went to the press because she couldn't get the league to look into them.
So the league has now called off five games scheduled for this weekend. Have we heard anything else from them in the way of a response?
No, I mean, I think that Lisa Baird, you know, said she worked with the players to have this postponement, but I think that she's still absolutely, you know, under pressure. I think there are real questions about how Riley was rehired. In the case of all of the coaches that were fired this year or dismissed, they've all faced previous allegations of misconduct. I reported that Richie Burke had been accused of abuse at the Washington Spirit, and he was hired anyway. So I think that, you know, there's real questions about how the coaches in the league kept getting hired into these jobs.
So all of this has unfolded really in a matter of several weeks. When, like a lot of abuse scandals, once one story comes forward, the dam kind of breaks and more people come forward. Is there a sense that there could be more stories from within this one women's soccer league?
Unfortunately, I think there is. I think that, you know, as soon as players start feeling safe, they are going to keep coming forward. And I'm certainly, you know, looking and have heard of other stories. I think there's unfortunately a lot more to come out. And the question is, you know, how is the league going to deal with this moving forward?
One of the things about the National Women's Soccer League that a lot of people might not know is they associate, you know, the world superstars like Megan Rapinoe and Alex Morgan and Carly Lloyd, and they play at their level. But most of the women in this league are barely making a living playing a sport that they love. What does all of this tell us about the power dynamic at play and the kind of position that these women are in?
The NWSL is incredibly restrictive on the rights of players, I think more so than most professional sports leagues. There's no free agency of any kind. You know, players can be traded at any moment, at any point, no matter how long they've played for a team. And this is all in the context of most of them making less than $30,000 a year. You know, this year the players union has raised this campaign where they're all working second jobs, or many of them are, just to get by. And so I think that more than most, you know, professional men's sports leagues, you're right, there is this power imbalance. There is this dynamic where women don't have the economic power. The players I spoke to, some of them that were afraid to go on the record, they couldn't lose their jobs because they were making $30,000 a year, and they were simply just economically not able to get by if they lost their job. And that's just the reality that most of them are facing.
We know you're going to be sticking with this story. We'll be following your reporting on it as well. That is Molly Hensley-Clancy, sports investigative reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And late today, soccer's international governing body, FIFA, announced that it has opened an investigation into the sexual harassment allegations. And now to the analysis of Brooks and Capehart. That is New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, columnist for The Washington Post. As always, it is so good to see both of you.
Great to see you too, Judy.
Thank you for being here. But what we are going to talk about first is the mess. We were just describing it, Jonathan, on Capitol Hill. They've gone day after day. They can't come to an agreement. The Democrats can't come to an agreement on the president's priorities. He himself was there today. Why is this so hard to get done?
I think it's so hard to get done, Judy, because Democrats understand that even though the presidential term is 4 years, the way the presidency is these days, it's really just 1 year. Nothing is going to get done in Washington on Capitol Hill come 2022 because of the 2022 midterms. And the fact that the House majority, Democratic House majority, hangs in the balance in 2022, maybe even also the Senate majority hangs in the balance. And so what's happening is Democrats are trying to cram in every policy priority that they have into that reconciliation bill. And right now, no one seems to want to give up their pet project. But we're getting down to the wire here where folks are going to have to decide, what's your number one priority? You can't have everything. What's your number one priority, and how can we get to yes? And you call it a mess, and it is a mess, but I think we're so unused to legislating that this is what's happening. Usually it's between Democrats and Republicans. It's kind of hilarious that it's Democrats negotiating with Democrats, but that's what's happening here.
Hilarious, but David, for the speaker and for the president and others, it's, you know, they want to get this done and it's not happening.
Yeah, well, that yesterday was definitely a setback for Nancy Pelosi. How many times in her years as leader have we seen her not in control of her caucus? That's rarely happened. And she was not in control and didn't have the votes she thought she had. yesterday. But I have a feeling they're coagulating their way toward a solution. It may take weeks, but I think they will get there. And the difference between $1.5 trillion and $3.5 is a big difference. And that's why it's so hard. And I think one thing that may clarify is that they figure out, what is this for? As Jonathan said, right now this is for everything. There's a whole Democratic agenda thrown into one thing. But they're not going to get everything. They're going to come down, as Lisa said, and I've been hearing, to $2.5 trillion. So how do we do that? And I would say, what is this for? To me, this is for, over the last 50 years, folks without a college education in some of the poorer parts of the country have been left behind. And there are a lot of things in this measure that would redistribute money from folks with a college degree who are doing well toward folks without a college degree who need some help, both in the child subsidies, the jobs. And that would be a major accomplishment if we could rewrite some of the bad distribution that's been happening over the last 50 years, and if we could show that we respect the dignity of those people who, you know, have been left behind. And if you can have a $2.5 trillion bill that shows respect for those who's left behind, that's an amazing legacy for any party or president.
And it is, both of you are saying, Jonathan, that the progressives are very clear that this is what they want. And I hesitate to put a label on everybody else, but the moderate, more moderate Democrats are saying, wait a minute, it's too much money. What's at the heart of this division among Democrats?
Well, I mean, I think what's at the heart is they all want to get this done. If you talk to them, do you support the bipartisan infrastructure plan? They all do. Do you want some of the things that are in the reconciliation bill? They all want things that are in the reconciliation bill. Right now, everyone has to focus on the content instead of the price tag. I disagree with David in that this has, you know, been a setback for Nancy Pelosi, simply because the talks are ongoing. If the talks had broken down and everyone had left Washington, that would be one thing. But the president went to the Hill. He talked to the conference. From some of the reports I've heard, he made it very clear to them what he wants them to do. I think that they will come to some sort of agreement that makes it possible to vote on the bipartisan plan while still punting down the road the work on the reconciliation bill. It has to happen because the Democrats need it, but also it's the president's agenda. The progressives have been very smart in saying that this isn't us arguing with each other. This is the president's plan. We're not the radicals here. This is the president's plan. And at the end of the day, I think that's what's going to carry the day for this.
And David, I mean, the two of the figures we've been talking about throughout this process are Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. I looked up today, the population of those two states together is 9 million people out of a country of 330 million. How do they have as much clout as they do?
Well, it's a 50-50 Senate, and I think there are a bunch more, John Tester. There are other moderates who are sort of hiding behind their coattails. But, you know, Joe Biden was elected as the most moderate member of the Democratic primary field. So there are moderates in the Democratic Party who probably worry about the spending. I think Joe Manchin, some of the things I'm not crazy about, but when he says we should means test, we should not be subsidizing upper middle class people with whatever pre-K education, but we should be focusing our money on those who are most in need. That's not a stupid argument. I think a lot of means testing is one way they could bring the cost of this down. There's going to have to be decisions made. If they have to bring it down by, say, a trillion, are we going to do Medicare expansion in this? Are we going to do climate change? And reading what the progressives seem mad about right now, it seems like some of the climate change stuff may be on the chopping block. The worst thing they could do is keep every little piece of the bill, but just make it cheaper. And that would ensure that they did everything badly. And so they've really got to make some priorities. And if it comes to shove, then Joe Biden's got to say, okay, here's the compromise that I support. You're either, you know, you're going to support your president or you're not. And I think they will get to that. When I hear the Democrats talking, I do not hear them erecting walls. I hear them getting to yes, but in a way where they get the most.
Do you agree the worst thing they could do would be to just cut everything a little bit to get to a lower number?
Well, it depends on how you're defining cut. One of the options I've heard is, you know, this is a 10-year plan. This is not a one-year plan. It's a 10-year plan. So if you have the child tax credit, say, or a free community college over 10 years, well, what if you scale it back to 5 years? How much does that bring down the cost of this infrastructure plan? Congresswoman Susan Del Bene, she's the chair of the New Democrats. She's all about, let's do a few things well, and then be able to say, show the American people that we've got this done. So if you shrink the number of years that a program carries over, then that brings down the cost. If you focus on a few things and do them well, that would bring down the cost. But they've got to do something to get everyone to yes.
There's a little smoke and mirrors in that. When we'd have these cliffs where, oh, it's going to be only a child tax credit for 3 years. Well, we all know it's going to be permanent. You're just not counting the money you actually are spending. So there's a little chicanery, I would say, in some of these cliffs that they built into this.
A little chicanery, just a little. But just from the both of you, how much President Biden has riding on this? I mean, he has to get this done. Is that fair to say?
Yes, absolutely. As the progressives have been arguing correctly, this is the president's agenda. It's called the Build Back Better Act. That's his whole campaign slogan. And he ran on everything that is in that bill. And if a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate cannot pass, get the Democratic president's agenda passed, then what's their argument in 2022 to be left in the majority, and what's his argument in 2024 to be reelected? That's why this is so important.
Yeah, and the weakness for Biden right now in this poll slide is competence. Can he do stuff? And if he can't be competent, then the whole reason for his election. So he'd be in real trouble if that happened.
So we're talking about 2022, 2024, but there is an election. There are two elections happening this year for governors. One of them, New Jersey, we think we know what's going to happen there. But in the state of Virginia, Jonathan, you have the former governor, Democrat Terry McAuliffe, facing off against a Republican, Glenn Youngkin, who worked in private equity, I think, for 25 years. This race is closer than the Democrats have seen in a while. Mm-hmm. Democrats are nervous. And we've got just a clip of a debate in the last few days between Mr. Youngkin and Terry McAuliffe. Let's listen.
There's an over and under tonight on how many times you're going to say Donald Trump. And it was 10, and you just busted through it. You're running against Glenn Youngkin. Who knows who's going to be running for president in 2024? And
if he's the nominee, will you support?
Who knows? Let me just start. If he's the Republican nominee, I'll support him.
Here's my message to Congress. I am really sick and tired of all of them. You know what? They ought to follow the Virginia model. We got things done. That's why so many Republicans have endorsed me. We do things in a bipartisan way. They got to stop their little shitty chat up there.
So what you get a taste of the debate from that, Jonathan, is Terry McAuliffe talking about, you know, we need more bipartisanship. But with Glenn Youngkin, who has been endorsed by President Trump and has said he would vote for him if Trump were the nominee, how do you see this contest?
Well, look, when Terry McAuliffe won the Democratic primary, I saw someone very close to him, and I just said, no, congratulations at the crowded field. You won the primary. And so now what's it looking like in the general? And the person said to me, that was the easy part. Glenn Youngkin is someone who's not going to be easy. So what we have in Terry McAuliffe is someone who always runs as if he's 50 points behind. But the fact that Terry McAuliffe came out of the gate understanding the challenge that Glenn Youngkin poses, I think puts him in the right mindset to tackle him. The thing about in that clip that you just showed of Glenn Youngkin saying, you know, you can say Donald Trump all the time. Donald Trump is a motivator for the Democratic base. And that's exactly what Terry McAuliffe is going to need if he is going to turn these slim poll majorities that he has within the margin of error, and some of them, into electoral victory.
What does this look like to you?
Yeah, I mean, Virginia has swung pretty blue. The fact that this is close, I don't think it's Terry McAuliffe's fault. I think it's just their headwinds for Democrats because of President Biden's approval rating, because of COVID. What's striking me about the race is the strongest argument that McAuliffe can make against Youngkin is, you're a Republican. And Youngkin is saying, well, I'm kind of a Republican. I'm sort of a never-Trumper, but I'm also a forever Trumper. I'm kind of a Republican, but not really. And Youngkin's strongest argument against McAuliffe is, you're a Democrat. And he's like, well, I'm not like those Washington Democrats. So the parties are unpopular. And so the candidates, especially for governor, are saying, well, I'm kind of in the party, but I'm kind of not in the party. I'm more tied to Virginia than I am to a party. And they're both doing this dance. I think both of them are doing it pretty effectively. You still have to think it's a Democratic state. If McAuliffe loses, I would think that would be a sign of national headwinds for Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, the question, one of the questions about this race, as both of you are saying, Jonathan, is how much of a factor is President Trump on the ticket a year after this governor's race, they'll vote in early November. How much of a factor is Donald Trump?
Well, he's a factor because for Democrats, he's a motivator. People are still angry at him for what he did to the country during his administration. But also Youngkin's answer about, well, if he's the nominee, I'll vote for him. Well, if Donald Trump isn't the nominee, that Republican is going to be a MAGA-esque person. And so for Democrats, that's, you know, okay, so it's not Trump. Well, we have to still worry about Republicans. And so that's why I think Donald Trump is a major factor in this. And to your point about, you know, they don't want to be part of the parties, one of the reasons why Terry McAuliffe is saying, you know, Washington, get your act together, you know, pass this bill. Yeah, he's running away from them now, but if they end up passing the bipartisan bill, he's going to be a very proud Democrat.
Yeah, the man did run the Democratic Party for a while.
But I mean, every Republican running from now until certainly till 2022 and then 2024, as long as Donald Trump is around, is going to be asked, you know, what's your connection?
Right, and it's going to be problematic, but I think his success so far, moderate success in the polls at least, is that you can do it. You can say, I'm for Virginia. This is not national politics. I'm for Virginia. But who knows what Donald Trump is about to do? He might say, if you're not 100% with me, I'm going to come out against you. And that would be really poisonous for any Republican office holder. So a lot of it is, how does Donald Trump want Republicans to win state races? Not clear that he does.
And he's chastised, I guess, Youngkin and other Republicans who haven't been sufficiently embracing.
Yeah, he was in Georgia, and he said nice things about Stacey Abrams because Brian Kemp did something he didn't like.
All right. We are going to leave it there. David Brooks, Jonathan Capehart, thank you both.
Thanks, Judy.
And on the NewsHour online right now, TikTok can be more than just a platform for humor. It can also act as a tool for social advocacy. Online, we examine how indigenous content creators are sharing their culture and calls for justice. That's on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And for more analysis of Democrats' division on infrastructure and increasing distrust in government and science, join moderator Yamiche Alcindor and her panel on tonight's Washington Week. That's later this evening on PBS. Tomorrow's edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend looks at how a group of former Vietnamese refugees in Seattle is helping newly arriving Afghan refugees, and a behind-the-scenes look with the cast and author of Tina, the Tina Turner musical, as the show prepares to reopen on Broadway. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here Monday evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe and have a good weekend.